welcome to the latest episode of Your Wealth with Gemma Dell, a podcast series designed to help you create, grow, and protect your wealth.
Hi, and welcome to Your Wealth. I'm Gemma Dell, NAB Trades Director of SMSF and Investor Behaviour. We've recently talked about understanding bonds with Mark Todd, who is NAB's fixed income and bond guru and a regular market commentator on the Your Money channel. Today, I thought we'd ratchet things up a notch and talk about some of the recent commentary about the quality of global credit that's currently on issue and some of the risks that are in play in global credit markets. This can sound incredibly obtuse and boring, but it's worth remembering that the global financial crisis, which affected all of us around the world, was literally the result of poor quality credit. It was people borrowing money they couldn't afford to repay, and that hurt a lot of people who didn't hold any bonds at all. So let's find out how serious this is. Mark, thanks so much for joining me.
Pleasure, Gemma. It all comes down to the bond market, the incredibly boring bond market.
It's the centre of the universe. So Mark, firstly, can you explain what is meant when we talk about credit quality? We use these sort of fairly obtuse terms. So what is credit quality? How do you tell high quality credit or high quality bond from a poor quality bond?
The challenge in the bond market is to bring it home to people who aren't invested in the bond market in any way, shape or form, intellectually, physically, that sort of stuff. Obviously, it's a huge market globally. But if you think about it, you should probably think about it to answer that question from the borrower's perspective. Mm-hmm. So if you were an 18-year-old person, new to work and wanted to go and borrow some money, mm-hmm. and you compare that to dual income, no kids, looking to borrow some money, mm-hmm. you'd probably say, I need to assess it on the risk. What's the likelihood of either party being able to repay their debt? So that's where they start to think about good quality versus bad quality credit. Mm-hmm. It's the chance to repay. Now, what the assessor will do, whoever the assessor might be, is they will look at the history. They won't look at just at the history of the 18-year-old. They'll look at the history of all 18-year-olds. They'll say, what's the likelihood of all 18-year-olds defaulting? What happens? Mm-hmm. Versus dual income, so on and so forth. So the way to then think about this in terms of good quality, high quality, is what's the probability of default and the loss given default? That's what they talk about. So what is the likelihood of the dual income, no kids repaying? Mm-hmm. And that's the probability of default. And then the loss given default is, well, what assets do they have that I can sell, and what's the loss given if they default? Mm. That all makes sense. So then you think about if the bank, the NAB, defaults, where do we rank? Now, if you have a term deposit, loss given default at $250,000 is negligible because there'll be government backing, you'll get your money. So loss given default is very, very limited. Mm-hmm. Probability of default is very, very limited, mm-hmm. because it's over the time frame. I have a 90-day TD. So what's the probability of the bank falling over in 90 days? It becomes a very high quality credit. So you have to think about, how long am I lending the money? What assets can I get if they don't pay it? And that's the sort of way to think about high quality, low quality. Now, there's ratings agencies that do that work for everyone. Mm-hmm. If you're a retail investor, you can't look at the ratings agencies. They don't sell on the basis of the ratings agencies because the powers that be have decided that that was used as a sales tool.
Right.
This is high quality. GFC, this is an A-rated instrument, and therefore when it didn't perform like an A-rated instrument, people lost money and it was really bad. So you need to then be very comfortable about things like probability and loss given. So how do you work that out? There's different means to do it, but I think intuitively you start to think about high quality in respect of what you know about that issuer. So an Australian bank issues paper, borrows money. You've probably got a better feel for that than, you know, a Brazilian petrochemical company.
Yeah.
So how do you make that difference? Yum Foods out of the US, they do, you know, KFC, they have Pizza Hut. What's happening in the Pizza Hut world? You know, it's harder to work out. So it's, again, you might try and find some experts, but that's the difference in credit quality. Think of it from the borrower's perspective.
I think your point about a term deposit, you know, it's effectively a bond, right? You have lent money to the bank to do something over a period of time, whether that's 90 days or 6 months or whatever it might be, and in the scenario that it's less than $250,000, for most people it is backed by a government guarantee. So that is the best you're going to get in terms of credit quality as an individual. But there are many other variables and many other types of credit. So looking at those and trying to understand what's the risk you're taking.
But importantly for the people here, ergo the yield will be lower.
Yes.
You're taking less risk.
Mm.
So the borrower says, well, if there's not much risk, I don't have to pay a lot.
No. Nope.
You have to think about it in that context. The person borrowing the money is saying, I'm giving you so much assurance.
Mm.
So you can't really sting me for a huge rate on that one.
Yeah, fair enough. So I've read two pieces recently, and many of our listeners would have seen similar sorts of articles, suggesting that the quality of the global credit corporate bond issuance. So this is companies issuing credit, not
investment
governments.
Grade companies.
Yeah. So bonds issued by companies globally.
Yep.
It's really deteriorated over the last couple of years. And they're specifically referencing an increase in lower rated bonds. So the credit agencies that you were talking about saying, look, this is not an A grade anymore. This is a much lower quality, therefore much less likely to be able to repay. And also the lower spread. So the people are getting less return on it, even though the chance of it being repaid is lower.
Mm.
To the point you made before, if your chance of being repaid is very high, you would expect a low rate of return. But if you're willing to take a bit more risk, you should be... should mm-hmm. be compensated for that. And so this particular article was saying that's not happening anymore. What are your thoughts on that?
One thing, there's a couple of things. The first is be mindful of the fact that anyone who writes from the bond market is naturally pessimistic. They see fear everywhere. That's the bond market.
Mm.
Bond markets are binary. I get my money back or I don't. I get a coupon, or I live in this world of fear, what could happen? And then they talk about the credit quality and it, as it relates to, and I think it's very hard for the people listening to this, it needs to relate to your entire portfolio.
Mm.
In other words, ratings agencies have made the decision that they should continue to lift the hurdle higher to maintain an A rate, to get those ratings. So post the GFC, higher hurdles. That's absolutely appropriate, no problem. The issuers themselves have to change so that they become higher. So if the ratings agencies lift it higher, how do the corporate become higher? Now, what are the corporates doing? I think investment grade corporates issue about $100 billion a month, a bit more.
Mm.
Have done so over the last years. That's what they do. Think of it's we're talking the US market, so it's not all US names.
Mm.
NAB will go into the US market and borrow in the US market. It's the big dog in the room.
Right, okay.
If I think about what's happened in the US, say tax changes, corporates are making more money. They're more profitable, they're getting tax benefits. But what do? They might financial engineer, they might issue some bonds like Apple and pay a dividend off those bonds. There's different mechanisms taking place. Now, the article, I have no problem with the article whatsoever. One of the ways to gauge the analysis would be the return I'm making above the US government bonds is less than I used to be able to make. So the spread, the margin.
Mm.
Okay, let's think that through. If a corporate borrows at 6% and the US rate is at 1,
yep.
I get 5. All pretty good.
Yeah.
US rates have gone higher.
Yes.
Corporates haven't gone with them.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay.
That's where we're talking about the spread compression. So it's the quality of the corporates that the article was worried about.
Mm.
And it's the margin you're getting above.
Yeah.
So the article is basically saying maybe you would be better buying US government debt.
Right.
The people listening to this don't have immediate access to US government debt. But US government debt is going higher, and it's going higher for a few different reasons which we can explore. But it's the underlying going higher.
Yeah. Your benchmark's going higher.
So in short, the standards are going higher. Global economies are probably still pretty fine.
Hmm.
So if you think about lending to those global economies in isolation, maybe it might be a good thing to lend to corporates. Corporates might be charging a little bit less, the margin is less, and the underlying is going higher. I think a lot of people who invest in credit are saying, what is the story of global economies first and foremost? When you invest in more than credit, which all the people here will be doing, you need to put it in that context.
Yeah.
If I have $100 and I put no money to credit, that's not really a great strategy. So do I put some money? I might put $1, $2, $3. I might do something like, I'm not saying everyone will put $100 there because you're not getting a great return. But you need to think about it in context of your entire portfolio, where the article will be about a specific asset class. And that's very important to differentiate corporate credit, government credit, floating, fixed, all sorts of things. So it's more to it than just in isolation, this is what's happening.
Yeah, fair enough. So one of the points you just made is that investors don't have access, direct access to government bonds. Although that is, you know, there are things are much more available and accessible than they used to be. So one of the things that is interesting is that people can actually access government bonds via an ETF, for example, or they'll access a proxy for government bonds.
The last week, the money going into the 1 and 3 year part of the ETF for US government was hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars.
Right.
You know, we saw a lot of people move into that. That was probably more driven by investors. So they're quite fluid, and I have no problem. You know, people do that. I don't know that a lot of our viewers do that, but a lot of people do that, if you get what I mean. It's, so I'm not saying don't do it. You just have to go and call up Nick at the high value desk and say, you know, what can I buy an ETS?
Yeah.
But you can segment away 1 to 3 years. You can go middle part of the curve, long part of the curve. I don't have any, you know, I don't have any problems with any of that. It's just, does that suit your investor profile?
So one of the points then made in a different recent article, this one was published by Bloomberg. It was written by a very famous financial commentator. He's an Australian, but he is published globally, and he was referencing the GFC.
Yeah.
And he was saying that bonds are generally packaged up for retail and also many types of institutional investors. So they're not buying a bond, as you say, they're buying a bundle of bonds. And during the GFC, that was what brought us all undone, was bundled up bonds that looked like they were very high quality and were rated as if they were high quality, but there was some stuff in there that people had no chance of ever repaying. So when those were not repaid, the whole thing started to unravel. And his point was that perhaps investors are now buying bundles of bonds that are much lower quality than they realise, and there are GFC-like risks in some of those parts of the market. He's not saying the whole market, he's saying some parts of the market. Thoughts on that one?
So he was talking about CLO, so it's collateralized loan obligations.
TLA, three-letter acronym.
Yeah, I love it. So I think, again, not many people. That's more an institutional market. People buy those things.
There's no retail investor I know who has that kind of product.
Correct.
In their
$10 and $20 million clips or even more. I think it is fair to say, I could be wrong, but it's fair to say that the regulators, and I know that I just read a Bloomberg commentary on Japan, how they're asking the people that invest in CLOs, institutions and banks that invest in CLOs who are looking to get yield for their customers, need to put a lot of capital aside unless the issuer, the people arranging it, co-invest.
Right.
So that will be some legislation that will come out for end of March. In, to my mind, I think the idea that you should know what you're investing in is a fundamental issue. I would then say, we really, it's Rumsfeld. You know, we don't know what we don't know. So we think we know.
Can you remember the exact quote for people? There are known knowns, there are known unknowns, and then there are the unknown unknowns, or something to that effect. Yes, right.
So everyone knows the Rumsfeld strategy.
Yeah, the unknown unknowns are what you're worried about.
Yeah. So if I think about that in respect of Dick Smith, Channel 10, you make some presumptions. And one of the ways that I like investors to ponder, I want you to invest on the basis of what you think you know to the best of your ability. I don't want you to invest on the basis of fear.
Mm.
Completely different outcomes. If I invest on the basis of fear, I'll just buy term deposits and ultimately I don't get home in terms of investments. So I need to work longer. It really does impact my, you know, existence. Whereas if you assume that you don't know everything, I want you to then think about what is your exit strategy look like? Because it's really important to realize that if because you don't know everything, and know is the important word, you make some assumptions, probability of loss given default, that's, you make some assumptions on your equities, on everything. I think you need to think of what is your exit strategy when you make an investment. And the exit strategy, if you go to sell at the same time everyone's going to sell, if you try and hit the exit door, that exit door gets tighter all the time.
Mm.
So the way to ponder your exit strategy is not necessarily sell the underlying asset. And this is really important. Let's think about the hybrid market. Mm-hmm. That's a security market, major bank hybrids. If in the event that you think the hybrid market is coming under some pressure because people cannot meet their obligations, well, wouldn't it be wise to buy really long-dated, out-of-the-money puts on the issuer? Because the equity would obviously plummet.
Mm.
So my exit strategy is linked to the underlying asset, that is loss given default. I might make some money back, but in the event that this thing goes under, I've got another strategy that says I will take the benefit of it.
Yeah, you've got some protection.
And so to think about it in that respect, what is the context of my investment strategy and my exit strategy? So if I'm buying corporate loans, now that is harder, but it's the same deal. Who are the corporates? What am I doing? What is the actual investment? And then what is the return? And then what's the exit strategy look like? So what do I do? Now, I'm guessing, if a whole bunch of corporates go under, then, you know, stock market will get sold off, I'm assuming.
You've got bigger things to worry about than just your bond portfolio.
But you've got some investment strategies.
Mm.
You could say, if these things don't work out, if there is a GFC on these things, I sort of know what happens.
Yeah.
To an extent. So I want to, with volatility being as low as it is, I might put $10 to that strategy if I live in fear, if I'm worried. Now,
or even if you just want some downside protection.
We're hugely keen on that strategy for customers that can't take volatility because of where they are in their cycle.
Mm.
So that if they've got the sequencing risk, if they are about to move into a retirement phase, say, okay, so what protection are you looking to do? We buy protection for life insurance through the growing phase, so all the family's okay. Then we move into another phase and we say, what insurance policies do I now need? Well, is it worthwhile talking to your advisor saying, can you give me an insurance policy on my portfolio? Because that's what will sustain my life, my investment life, my spending life, because I no longer work or I'm working less. Go to your advisor and ask the advisor for that, because that's where you should come to the NAB. We've got a whole bunch of people making strategies around that. So Bernard and people like that in the equity team are thinking of those strategies for customers, sophisticated clients. That's how you think about your investments.
Yeah.
To my mind, you know, and this is purely my opinion, but you know, you don't always get it right.
But it's an interesting one. It's very valuable for investors to think about having downside protection. I think a lot of people, when you are trying to understand your exit strategy, it can be quite nerve-wracking. And as you say, very few people, we're all dreadful at picking the bottom, dreadful at picking the top. You know, timing is extremely difficult. Even the best in the world don't get it right consistently. And that challenge of having the right parameters in place to make a decision based on when you get in, when you get out, most people don't do that very well. So some protection is a more effective mechanism potentially for some people than trying to have an explicit entry and exit point.
Yeah. But I'm saying the important thing is define it when you make the investment on the day.
Yeah, have clarity in advance.
Think about it. Okay, if this isn't what it says it will be, what is my plan in a year's time? What is the strategy that I will do?
Yes.
That's fine. Just do that.
Yeah.
That gives you a little bit of sleep at night, Phil, as well.
I think that's really valuable. I'd be very interested to see how many people respond to that. It'll be the kind of thing that people probably sparks a great deal of interest. There's been quite a bit of change from a legislative perspective in terms of how product can be bundled. And the comment you made about the Japanese regulators requiring that product issuers have skin in the game.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a huge fan of that term. We use it all the time. But anyway, that they are also at risk if your funds...
They have to co-invest.
They also are at risk if you have your funds at risk. Does prevent some of the behaviour we saw pre and during the GFC where issuers had bundled stuff up with the explicit objective of getting it off their books as quickly as possible, making as much money as possible, but clearly passing the risk to somebody else. Mm. So I mentioned ETFs before, and this is becoming something that does concern people, which is so much passive money now sits in the market that if there is a downturn or people start to reduce their exposure to certain types of the market, there could be a forced selling issue and something of a sort of downward spiral. So investors decide they want to get out of the corporate bond market or whatever it might be. They start selling ETFs. ETFs are then forced to sell the portfolio. People see the ETFs dropping in the market. But, you know, so it becomes this sort of vicious circle where there is continuous downward pressure because of the nature of the passive part of the market. Yep. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, so there's a couple of things. I think the way to ponder the changes that have taken place in banking, to your earlier point around transferring risk and not being co-invested, the cost, the appropriate cost through fines and the like, have meant that some of the banks have, no, all the banks have changed their behaviour and are both mandated, legislated, surveilled to think that they won't do this again, that they will stop to do this again. It's not just built on wanting to acquire a trusting relationship with the customers, which, you know, we do want to try and do that. There is also the big stick that says if you do that, it's going to affect a lot of people. You know, it's so there's it would be harder for bad apples to create bad apples, but, you know, there's no guarantee that they won't do that. In terms of the ETF, I understand the possibility of being forced sellers if everyone goes the same way. I think that ETF story around driven by fee aversion. I don't want to pay any fees, so give me the cheapest thing. And then the vast selection that you can buy, all different types of ETFs everywhere. You know, I'm not a massive fan of that saying that fits my portfolio requirements. You know, I feel like I can find them elsewhere. I think I want to try and find I want to spend some money. The way to ponder this is I think I probably need to spend some money on a fee-based strategy for a portion of it. And in that portion, I probably want to find the fund manager that will look after me. Now, remember, no one loses sleep over their money like you do. But I want to find a fund manager who might be a little bit, you know, insomniac. So that if I find the right fund manager for a portion, I can think if the events that you describe take place, they can take advantage of it. So I think about it that way rather than my fee aversion. So I say, if I don't know these underlying assets, because I really don't on the ETF, I don't know, I'm picking a strategy because it's moving, I'm going to buy, you know, the energy sector because I think it all works. Well, they're short-term strategies. They're, you know, move it up, move it down. But if I'm trying to find the right manager to buy in an asset class that I don't easily access, I might spend a little bit of my money, my very hard-earned money, on that manager. And then on other parts of my portfolio, I'm investing my money because I know what I want to invest in, you know, whether it be, it doesn't really matter, you know, but I think about my fees more strategically rather than no fees.
Yeah.
Because if it's a no fee strategy, then I have a no fee result, which means I don't have an expert, I'm the expert. I now need to be the expert on everything.
Well, the market is the expert, and we know that, as I said, markets can stay irrational a lot longer than we can stay solvent sometimes. I think it is quite an interesting point that you make. I think professional managers, the advantage they have is that in crazy times, they can choose their responses. With an ETF, the only response you have is buy or sell.
Yeah.
If you hold it, you get what the market gives you, which in very tricky times may not be what you're after.
Mm. And, you know, if you are subject to the very tricky times and that really hurts you, then you can't have a lot of money invested in that piece of it. So, you know, you need to be in, again, it's always about what's my exit strategy. So if I'm in heavily invested in ETFs, then I have one exit strategy, which is just sell that.
Yeah.
I think, you know.
It's worth noting as well, you made a comment earlier, you know, if that happens, there's a downturn. There will be a downturn, right?
Sure.
It's inevitable. That is the nature of markets. So there will be a downturn at some point. It's simply well,
last quarter, you know, 2018 last quarter was definitely a downturn.
Yeah, absolutely.
So a lot of people would have reacted to it. Other people would have said, you know, I'm not worried about volatility. I'm going to stay on.
Right. Random insight on the downturn in the last quarter of 2018. So self-managed super funds on NabTrade were net buyers, quite aggressive net buyers from October through to January. And then in February, they started selling again, which was quite interesting. So self-managed super funds are generally net buyers. So 8 out of 10 periods in the market, they will buy. They've got heaps of cash they can afford to generally, and yet we've seen them start to sell. So they were buying quite aggressively when the market came off, and as it rallied, they think there's no more opportunity in that rally, and they've moved out.
It's a very bitter rally. It's Game of Thrones. It's cold. You know,
people don't winter like is it. Coming.
Yeah, people don't like it. They don't have any confidence in it. I think it's all the noise around. You know, can China and the US work it out?
Yeah.
It is a bitter rally.
I've not heard that expression before, but I like it because I think it resonates strongly with how many people are feeling it. It feels tenuous, I think, for many of us. You talked about rising rates in the US. There has been this risk of rising rates killing bond prices, and it seems to have abated pretty quickly now that the Fed in the US has changed their tone. Clearly in Australia, the issue of rising interest rates is almost off the table, certainly not discussed with anywhere near the confidence that it was discussed a year ago. Are there other risks to global rates staying low rather than rising?
It seems to be that that's the case. I think the way I'm trying to understand the risks, I'm more aligned to the secular stagnation strategy of the world. I think there's more to it. I think we're doing a conference in August the 1st in conjunction with Kanga. We do it every year. We get about 500 investors. And the theme this year is what is the future? And we have a futurist coming, and we've been doing a lot of work with people to try and tell us the trends that we're seeing in, you know, cities. What will cities look like in 10, 20, 30 years?
Mm.
What will water look like? What will energy look like? That sort of stuff. And the demographic story is definitely fascinating. And I think it is hard to imagine we can sustain high rates when, if you think of developed economies and their aging populations, what are they aspiring to? Like, what are they? Are they in growth phase or are they in retirement phase? You know, generally, you know, you've got to look at macro themes. And then if you think about the emerging markets, what rate can they hold to continue to emerge, which is more about the FX rate as it relates to them? It does not seem to me that we have to pull this horse back. You know, it does not seem to me that, like, there is the risk that it is going to rapidly move forward and we have to say, let's curtail it. Wages have not really been growing. Inflation is always under pressure. I find it hard to imagine we'll go back to the rates that we once had. So I think it's this, in my mind, this secular stagnation. And I think a lot of people are very confused by it. And I think academics will do a lot of work on it. They're trying to understand it. But why is it when you have unemployment rate at 5%, we had the Centuria CEO, John McBain, in for a chat. Sydney and Melbourne vacancy rates in office and industrial, so in other words, the untenanted piece, was around about 3.4%. John McBain is not a young man. He's not a very old man, but he's not like he's 13. He said in his working life, in all the property, he's never seen it. That there's this much or this much of rental usage, that there's such a low vacancy rate. So the economy seemed to be strong.
Yeah.
But everyone's glass half empty, and it may be about property in residential. But it just doesn't feel to me that everyone's saying, I'm in the 1980s where it's just go gangbusters. It doesn't feel that.
Mm.
And I wonder if there's more to do with secular stagnation and the changing nature of work. I mean, about the rapid change that's taking place in the way people do work with artificial intelligence and the like.
That's such a fascinating perspective, and I think we should talk more about it at a different time. I think that if I think about the economics that I learned at university and the basic principles that held, they don't seem to hold in this environment, and they haven't held for a decade. And you're absolutely right. I think everyone's struggling to get their heads around that. Yep. It must be very difficult to go, everything we understood about how the economy works may not be true for some period to come.
How will we retire? What life will we have? What is the big picture, you know, changes? So that's why we like, you know, what is the future is a theme for a conference. And each panel will have a theme around what's happening in that future. And the panel will talk to, as an investor, this is how I think about it.
Mm.
So we'll have property people talking about cities. What are you doing? We'll have Pete Group, who have a listed bond that the NAB customers buy. They will talk about land banks and about cities and what they're doing. And it should be fascinating.
I think we'll talk about it more.
Sure.
Mark, you and your team produce brilliant insights on so much of this stuff. And it is, I think, incredibly powerful for people to realise that it's not just about the daily price of a bond. There's a lot more. There's a lot more thinking that goes into this stuff, right?
I'm making bonds sexy.
Yeah, you say that all the time. It's a challenge, but I'm impressed that you try. So, where can people find out more about the stuff that you're thinking about and talking about?
Well, we're doing so much more work with NabTrade. So, if we look at NabTrade as a great portal, you've got the Insights channel. We're doing stuff with the content team, so we'll be putting out regular videos. We do a hybrid update once a week now on NabTrade.
Cool.
We've just done our first few have gone out, so we'll just hopefully the viewers can watch that and give us some feedback how we can improve on that. We are going to do some director investor communications. One of the things that we have is a joint venture with NabTrade called NAB Portfolio Access, which is for those who are sophisticated investors. We'll be communicating to those customers. I think we've got 2,500 of those customers. And other than that, you can follow me on LinkedIn and Twitter and all that sort of stuff, or email me directly. It's mark.todd@nab.com.au. If you want to talk to me directly, no problem.
Awesome. Easy. Mark. Oh, also, if you're not a NabTrade customer and you want to get access to some of this stuff, it's free to join.
Yeah.
Just Google it or type in nabtrade.com.au and put in your details. You can become a customer with no obligation subsequent to that and access all of these insights. So it's a bit of
fun. Isn't that amazing how that's all evolving now, though? You can open up these accounts that have no obligations anymore, and you can say, look, I just want to see, because I think this is the real trend. People want information. I'm not saying they don't want advice, but a lot more people want information to be able to make a decision.
Yeah.
And so they're saying, I want information, and today has just been about information. There is nothing there that you can pull and say, he said buy that or do this. That's not what we're talking about anymore. We're talking about, let's have some engagement around education, and then we'll try and work it out from there. But let's get educated first.
I dearly love the trend toward treating investors and individuals as intelligent human beings who can make their own decisions. I think that's fantastic. You know, 20 years ago or 30 years ago, if you wanted to do most of the things we casually discuss, it was borderline impossible, right? You needed a copy of the white pages, and you had to use your landline to find a stockbroker, call them up, ask them if they had access to this stuff, see if you could, you know, the access points and the information available to people these days are extraordinary. And there are risks with that, of course, but I just think it is such a privilege as an individual to have access to the kind of information people have access to now. It's awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. It's sometimes it worries me that it's easier to open up a betting account and bet on a dog than it is to buy a very conservative asset. So I think it's great to spend some time just educating people.
Love it. Mark, thanks so much for joining me.
Pleasure.
As always, thank you so much for listening to this episode of the podcast. We hope it has been helpful in your journey to creating wealth. We do always love to hear from you. We mean that very sincerely. So if you have any feedback or suggestions for future topics, please just email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au. I'm Gemma Dale. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for listening to Your Wealth with Gemma Dale. To stay up to date, please subscribe to this podcast series or email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au.
Please note that any advice provided in this podcast has been prepared without taking into account your objectives, financial circumstances, or needs. Before acting, you should consider the appropriateness of the information. To find out more, please visit nab.com.au.